Good afternoon. My name is Ed Rafalski. I'm the Senior Vice President for Planning and Marketing at Methodist Healthcare in Memphis and faculty at the University of Memphis School of Public Health, University of Tennessee Health Sciences Department of Preventive Medicine. I'm going to talk to you about an effort we undertook to build a cancer registry in Memphis to address an issue of healthcare disparity. I have nothing to disclose in terms of relationships. In terms of the talk, I wanted to cover three things. What's the current state of disparity when it comes to breast cancer? Is it getting better or worse? And just a quick question, do you think it's getting better or worse? Those that think it's getting better, raise your hands. Very good, it's getting worse. And how do we build the registry to answer these and other questions? The story begins in Chicago. And in Chicago, a person by the name of Steve Whitman began to look at health disparity among blacks and whites when it came to breast cancer mortality. And what he found was that in the late 80s and early 90s, the difference between black-white mortality was relatively indistinguishable. And right around 1992, heading into the 1993-95 time period, we started to see a growing gap. And you can see the red line with white population mortality improving, whereas the black population remained essentially flat, therefore the disparity of 62% heading into 2007. And here's the same data just depicted in a table, so you can see it's getting worse over time. This led to a question, which is to say, was the problem unique to Chicago or was this a national phenomenon? So Whitman partnered with Jennifer Orsi and Mark Hurlburt from Avon Foundation, and they studied 25 major metropolitan areas in the United States. And in that study, they found that five cities led the nation in terms of breast cancer mortality disparity. Memphis was first. So that's a relative risk ratio of 2.09, which basically means a black woman's twice as likely to die from breast cancer than a white woman if she lives in Memphis. Not looking at any other variables. Denver was second, LA, Houston, and then Chicago rounded out the top five. That was interesting. But they asked the next question, which is to say, okay, we've looked at 25 cities, let's expand the question and look at 50. So they updated the study in 2012, and this came out in Cancer Epidemiology in April. These are the cities they studied in the second go-around, so a good cross-section of the United States. The methodology, they looked at 50 populous cities. Only 41 had usable data, which is to say complete registries in which they could abstract mortality data, let's say from death certificate data from departments of public health, for example. They computed the breast cancer mortality using rate ratios, as I showed to you earlier, and they looked over 20 years to see whether the trend was improving or not. Four time points with 5 years each to smooth over the effect, so you can see the cohorts there. And of the 41 cities they studied, 39 showed a black-white disparity in the final time interval. 23 of those were statistically significant. 35 saw an increase in disparity from the first time interval to the last. And this was almost entirely because the white rate improved substantially while the black rate remained flat or didn't improve at all. Here's the refreshed data now looking at the 50-city study, and you can see the U.S. average for blacks and whites is at 1.4. That's the relative risk. Memphis, again, in this updated study, was leading the nation at a relative risk ratio of 2.11, and you can see the rankings as they fell through the top 10. The best cities were Atlanta, Detroit, Omaha, New York, and San Francisco. So just to give a comparison. What was interesting, and I actually sat with Steve at a place called Central Barbecue in Memphis, and I asked him the question. I said, so how many women's lives who are African-American would we have to save in Memphis in order to eliminate the disparity? And he said 43, which, you know, law of small numbers. It seems like a small number, but yet it's enough to cause a disparity in the city of 1.4 million. So I look at this statistic and say to myself, this is very doable, which is to say if we can just intervene in 43 lives and do an effective job of navigating women to care, we could theoretically remove the disparity. If you look at it nationally over time, you could see, again, the white rate improving, similar to what we saw in Chicago, with a slight improvement in the black population. But when we looked at Memphis, what we saw was a significantly improving white rate and then a reversal of course in the last time period here of 2005 to 2009, where we started to see an increase in the disparity where more black women were dying compared to whites. So that leads us back to who we are and what we wanted to do as an organization. So very quickly, we're a faith-based organization, and we wanted to essentially address our mission to address issues of health disparity and health difficulties in all parts of Memphis, particularly in this instance for women that were African American that were seeing a higher disparity. We're a large system, $1.4 billion growing to $1.6, so we have the resources to impact upon this problem, and we're very effectively entrenched in all parts of Memphis, all neighborhoods, all areas. And this is just a visual to show you. We serve not only western Tennessee, but also eastern Arkansas and northern Mississippi. Why is this important in terms of disparity? Well, I like to share a couple of charts just in terms of what it is that might be causing the disparity. We don't know, but I'll tell you a couple of things. We're the epicenter for heart disease. So if you look at heart disease incidence, this is from the CDC. Memphis, Tennessee, if you look at the southern part of this map, you could see is the epicenter. And then in our part of the state, on the lower left, Memphis is the epicenter for the disease of heart disease. And if you look at stroke, it's the same pattern. I could go chart after chart after chart and show you the same pattern of activity. Why is that? Well, we think partly it's due to health behaviors. This is a ranking among all counties in all three states. The higher the number, the worse you're doing, basically. And in virtually every county that we serve, when we look at health behaviors, we're ranking among the worst counties in this particular state that we looked at. This was in 2009. Updated to 2013, health behaviors still remain a very low-performing statistic. The research that came out led to some national coverage. So it was covered in the New York Times in 2011 and in 2012. It was also covered by PBS NewsHour. And we elevated the conversation, in essence, telling the story. What are some of the issues? Memphis is a largely black and poor community. And what you can see in this chart is the white population essentially moving eastward and southern in a southerly direction out from the urban core, which is the light yellow. In terms of access, just overlaying screening locations, they're not equally distributed, and there's a lack of access, I would argue, in the lower income parts of Memphis proper, where we see the highest disparity. And just for a quick visual, this zip code in particular is the zip code that causes half the disparity in Memphis, yet there's no screening access in that particular geographic region. This initial problem led us to write a planning grant with Avon to build a cancer registry. So that, I wanted to tell you the story of what led to the registry building itself. We wanted to answer three basic questions. Do non-Hispanic black women wait longer to get to care? Are they underserved, and are we seeing a disproportionate proportion of population not getting to screening, particularly among younger women? That was a theory. It was a hypothesis we wanted to test. And did we think navigation was part of the answer? So three basic questions. And we asked the question, why is it important to build a disease registry? Well, here's what I would say. Administrative data is dirty, which is to say, very similar to our previous two presenters, if you're looking at trying to combine registries and fields from multiple providers, what you quickly find is that people don't use consistent definitions, the data is incomplete, and in many cases, missing. So the idea of building a registry in our case was to try to bring disparate data sets together and try to improve the quality of the information across the continuum. That was the basic premise. Here's a visual. Here's what it looks like. Our backbone at Methodist Healthcare is Cerner. We're Cerner Shop. That's our EMR vendor. We partnered with the West Cancer Center, which uses a product called Mosaic, so a separate EMR. We then added to that tumor registry data from our own tumor registry. And we also added another grant population from Komen, which is specifically dedicated to navigating patients to care. We're working on migrating, by the end of this year, our primary care data for practices that are owned by Methodist. They're on eClinicalWorks. So right there you could see the need for the registry. None of these databases talk to one another. So that was part of the problem we were trying to serve. It's a large database, 165 variables over 5 years, well over a million fields. This gives you a depiction of the matching that was done across multiple data sets. We were able to match 99% of the records for this particular effort around breast cancer screening and navigation. And I'm getting a little out of my space because the bioinformaticists at University of Tennessee led this work, but they used tools such as Pentaho's Kettle and Talon DI, both open source, to be able to do the matching. Here's one visual that gives you a depiction of race by stage. And by the way, we're using Tableau at our front end, which is a software package which allows us to depict the data. So you can do visual depictions of size of population, the stage, and the average age, which is the last number you see there on the chart. This was more interesting. This is looking at the average age of the population by stage, and what we found was African-American women were presenting at a later age with cancer, regardless of stage, whether you looked at stage 1 or stage 4. I wanted to share a couple of visuals. This is patient A, so you could see the continuum here. We start in 2011 with a breast cancer screening, and then you can follow the patient all the way through their care path up through 2013. Again, we're refreshing this data to bring in 2014. This patient is still surviving according to this view. Patient B died ultimately in 2013. The journey started, you can see at the very bottom there, in 2011. One thing I wanted to point out, although the numbers are small, is the number of days between encounters. You can see 129 days from the diagnostic mammogram before this patient died 250 months or later. And then lastly, patient C also passed 340 days passed since that patient had their last diagnostic mammogram. And so, you know, this kind of looking at it patient by patient, we began to see a picture of time differences to care. And so we wanted to analyze the statistics. And what we found was, and we looked at median days, was that African-American women were statistically waiting longer from the time they got screened to getting into care. So we look at median days. I'll tell you, on average, it's 30 days. So a black woman, if she gets screened, has a positive diagnosis, is taking 30 days longer to start her treatment plan than a white woman in Memphis, at least in our system. So what's the answer? Part of our answer has been navigation. One of the things and the reason we looked at it was the following. Now, this was a study that I did in Chicago, similar population in terms of demographics, but we just asked the question, why aren't you getting a mammogram if you're over the age of 40? And what we found was most of these reasons are reasons that can be intervened upon. One in five women said procrastination. One in 10 said, I need a doctor's order. Well, we all know you don't need a doctor's order to get a screening mammogram, yet they think they do. One in 10 said it was painful or embarrassing. Almost one in 10 said they didn't think it would be helpful. All of these things are things we can act upon, we think, through navigation and education. This led to this model. This was presented at Avon National Meeting earlier this year, and it's really looking at a combination of navigation approaches. Social workers, we all know, are one of the older professions in terms of this solution. We have community health workers. We've now added community navigators and advocates to be able to engage with patients, and these are typically lay professionals. They're people that live in the community, embedded in the community, that can interact with the patient. We've employed a model called the health belief model, which measures perceived risk, perceived benefits, self-efficacy, and barriers to care when you approach the patient and ask them the question. We're in the process, actually, of studying this right now, so I can't present any data, but the approach we're taking is trying to address these issues. Here's the result. So in this data registry that we built, we were effectively able to link just under 600 women under the Komen Navigation Program to Methodist Healthcare and West Cancer Center over 2 years. And you can see in the funnel, we identify 573 women. Remember, we're trying to just affect 40-some lives. So although they're small numbers, we think they're a very effective intervention. This led to 376 mammograms. You could see how many led to diagnostic procedures and how many then were referred to West Cancer Center for care. So in those previous three charts I showed you for individuals, we're now able to look at a cohort of people and saying, okay, who did we reach out to? Was the outreach effective? Did we get them screened? And if they were positive, did we get them into care? And did we get them into care sooner? And that's the operative question that we're trying to solve. I will tell you that This was through last year. We're now in currently phase four of the Komen grant. We changed our model. Under this model, we had one navigator doing outreach. We've blown up that model and saying we're not touching enough people. And so what we've done is we've empowered 11 navigators working with what we call our congregational health network, over 500 congregations in Memphis, working with liaisons in the congregation. And just through 4 months, we've been able to touch over 300 women. So we know we've now grown the outreach effort, and so next year we hope to see more effective intervention and navigation in reducing the disparity. Just wanted to acknowledge Steve Whitman here on the right, who wrote the two papers, passed away this year earlier, of all things cancer. So unfortunately we lost a great researcher. Just wanted to acknowledge his work and thank him for raising awareness on this issue. With that, are there any questions I could answer for you? None? We're good? Sure, please, yeah.
What do you think are lessons for scalability of this across the country? Because the other major cities are looking at this very same issue and probably hoping to learn lessons from your experience.
I think it's very scalable. I mean, I think it's scalable for a couple of different reasons. One is, as we move to, and we were talking about this before the talk today, standardized data structures. I'll give an example. So in our instance, we found that race wasn't being captured consistently at West Cancer Center, Methodist Health. We were just as guilty as the other providers of not doing a good job. Just standardizing the question, are you black, non-Hispanic, white, and being able to aggregate that data has allowed us to be more effective in terms of aggregating this data set. So I think it's very doable, and I think it's something we could pursue nationally, frankly, personal opinion.
Did you use the data from the Memphis, Tennessee registry, cancer registry?
That was part of what the tumor registry was part of it. We're not using the state registry
well,
yet.
That's the problem.
Yeah, that's
that's why you don't have standardized data, because state registries only have standardized data and they have to raise. I mean, that's required, and actually, I think I'm pretty sure Tennessee is at least a civil registry.
They are.
So you will also have the death certificates linked to those cases.
The problem,
I'm just saying
yeah.
in terms of like
oh, yeah,
data,
absolutely.
You would have that, and we actually did a similar study in Missouri, which we called it a neighborhood study. So it was in St. Louis in Kansas City, because we found the same thing, black women not getting the care in time, and that was actually the reason for, you know, increased mortality. So we did, I mean, it wasn't exactly the same, but we did something similar to that based on that data.
I don't want to disparage my own state, but I'll tell you this. It's very hard to work with our Department of Health and get data for analytics. That's one problem. And it's fair, because it's a big request to be able to say, give us all of your data.
Yes.
But the other thing I'll say is timeline.
Data.
And that is being able to say your intervention in a timely way, where I can look in my registry and say, last week we held an outreach event, we touched 50 women, and 30 got screened, and one was positive.
Right.
You know, the state lag in terms of time doesn't allow you to have that kind of timely conversation.
Yeah.
But I think we can get there. I don't think it's, this is not insurmountable. Yeah. That's right. So the Komen grant was written, and I didn't get involved until last year, so I was involved in the Phase 3 grant. Was only written for Shelby County, which is where Memphis is located. In the current phase we're submitting, we're expanding to include the four surrounding counties. So DeSoto in Mississippi, Tipton to the north of Shelby, Fayette to the east of Shelby, and then Crittenden County in Arkansas. So we'll be able to answer your question in the next phase, because we're going to expand the navigation and outreach to those rural communities. So that's the next effort. A good question. Other questions? Yeah, please. Sure.
So you talked about 30 days to get treatment.
On average.
On average. So how much of it is lack of access to an oncologist, or not having enough oncologists available to actually?
Well, interestingly enough, this will be another research agenda. When we joint ventured with the West Clinic, which is the largest oncology practice in Memphis, and that affiliation took place in January of 2012. So just as these studies are coming out, we've just now affiliated with West Cancer Center. And I'll tell you, and they're not proud of this statistic, but before the affiliation, only 2% of their patients were self-pay. In other words, no insurance. And Medicaid expansion, for those of you that are following, is not occurring in Tennessee, at least not of last conversation, nor have they been friendly to the Affordable Care Act. So we still have a lot of uninsured in our county and in our region. Since the affiliation, because of the ability to bring University of Tennessee, Methodist Healthcare, and West Clinic resources to the conversation, their self-pay has jumped from 2% to 12%. We think that, and our operating theory is many of these women are probably uninsured or were uninsured, just by providing access to self-pay and writing off the charity care, we think we've opened up access to oncologists. So we hope that when we pull the state data on mortality since 2011, we've actually seen an improvement. We just don't know yet. We've requested the data. I'm still waiting for the data to come to me. So, yeah, please. Right, we've been focusing on access. We've been focusing on and navigation as part of the solution to access. So that's been the focus because we believe that, and there is some research on this around the issue of trust and the issue of trust in the African-American community, of the provider community, in fact, the distrust of it. And bless you. And this actually, you know, just recently at the Civil Rights Museum at the Lorraine Motel, they held a talk about the Tuskegee experiments, and people in the community still remember Tuskegee. And so there's a sort of built-in mistrust of the establishment in healthcare, and so we believe that creating trust through navigation is the first step. And if you can create the level of trust and navigate the patient to a provider sooner, we could potentially reduce the adverse mortality and disparity. So that's been the operating focus so far. Yeah. What's the race? Oh, we have African American, white, and Hispanic Latino navigators. And interestingly enough, the Latino navigator is the most effective. I don't know why. That's something we have to study and figure out. But he's been it's a male, and he's been very effective in getting women in the community to come to the West Cancer Center or any other diagnostic centers to get screened who have no insurance through COMA. It's been very interesting to watch, and so he's become our point person in terms of the navigation effort. Any other questions? Yeah, please.
You mentioned that quite a few of these women are uninsured, so seeing the effectiveness of the navigators and getting them into screening, are the navigators also assisting with other health care issues? So perhaps if they need access to dental care, or even non-health care issues, child care?
So remember I showed you earlier that zip code to the south, which had the highest disparity, half the disparity was being driven. It's 38109 if you want to look it up, and roughly 50,000 residents. We've hotspotted that particular zip code as not only having needs in breast cancer care, but other types of healthcare issues. We've instituted a intervention with Cigna funding using navigation as part of the solution. So we have a community navigator working with difficult to manage multiple comorbid patients. I'm getting outside of the cancer space, but in those interventions, she has had people come up to her and say, I need dental care, or I need access to an oncologist. So we're actually seeing the lay navigator who's there talking about any health issue fielding questions around breast cancer, prostate cancer. One prostate cancer patient was in remission, had a recurrence, couldn't afford his drugs. It was a choice between drug therapy or eating, and didn't know that there was grant-funded charity care available that he could receive and get his drug treatment. And so she was able to connect him and get him care. So we're doing a little bit of that work. Any other questions? Good. Thank you very much.